51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. What would Cú Chulainn have to say for himself if he came back as a ghost? That's the question Eamon Carr asks and answers in his new short film, Cú Chulainn Awakes. It features Garrett Lombard as Cú Chulainn, Dennis Conway as a visionary seer, and Alwyn Fuere as the chorus. And it'll be screened online at the St. Patrick's Festival. It'll be on SPTV on Monday, the 15th of March. But delighted to have Eamon join us this evening. Cú Chulainn is the man to fix all our problems. It's that straightforward, Eamon, is it?
If only, yes. He might actually, might get us more vaccines. No, the curious thing was, around this time last year, I don't know if you had the same sensation, but it really did feel as if at one point, maybe going into April, as the daily death toll rose and we were looking at the Garden of Remembrance on TV news on a Sunday evening and so on. And there was just nothing but sadness. And it sort of felt almost as if the four horsemen themselves were just coming across the county line. But somewhere around then, a couple of lines popped into my head. And it was this voice that I had heard Garrett Lombard using in Dusk when he played the ghost of Cú Chulainn for us that time in the GPO and in the New Theatre. And I slightly ran with them for a bit, and I thought that maybe I might get a short soliloquy for Garrett to maybe perform for the Abbey, because they were commissioning something at the time. But when Andy Cummins heard it, or saw it rather, he said, look, do you want to just keep writing this and see where it takes you?
Yeah.
So I did, and then we chatted away on Zoom, and we decided that we'd try an experiment, because, you know, the actors, everybody was locked in their homes and nobody was moving outside their area and so on. And they were all locked down. So we decided we'd try and film the parts just on mobile phones, just as an experiment to see where it would take us. So we chatted about it and we tried different things. And then Garrett sent me a few clips, which frankly would have made my felt Tarantino's head spin. And I said, we're on to it. Let's do it. Let's go with this.
Well, let me ask you about that, specifically about the visuals of the Garrett Lombard piece, because they really jump off the screen at you. Because he's bathed in this kind of red light, and there's an almost satanic quality to it in some ways. But it's this voice from the graves, this voice of Cú Chulainn. Was that red light? Was that Garrett's own idea, or was that suggested to him?
Absolutely, no. That was Garrett himself. I mean, you know, the guy is a genius. But as it turns out, I mean, I don't want to reveal his secrets, because a number of people have asked me how he managed to do it, and I had to plead with him to tell me. But it's all, as they say, smoke and mirrors. But it's tremendous, the work he did. So anyway, there's no end to that lad's talent.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And little did I know he lived in a red light district, but there you go. clearly his...
don't mention Kilmainham.
Well, listen, let's that's the visual side of what Garrett is doing there. And we'll come back to what the other two, Alwyn and Dennis, are doing as well. But within, think of Garrett Lombard, just this almost disembodied, it's his head for the most part that we see, very shadowy red light. And this is how he addresses us after you, Eamon Carr, with your words, have resurrected from the grave, from the past. This is how he addresses us.
What dark hour is this? What calamitous cry is flung upon the air? What new scourge would have you summon me, the Hound of Cullen, from my lair? Though rattle my shield as I might, my enemy denies all sight, for foul flag against the sky, a mist of shadow hangs before my eyes. Testing times are these. Time for a champion to awaken courage and pledge, if you will, to spurn all evil, withstand all ills. In the common good against this dread, and side by side with neighbor and with friend, turn back the malignant tide, for fear it reaches flood.
And That's Garrett Lombard in a scene there from Cuchulainn Awakes, Eamon Carr's short film. Eamon speaking with us this evening. And Eamon, if you ever needed proof that a vital part of any actor's tool is the voice, boy, does Garrett Lombard prove it in this performance in particular. I mean, he has a great voice, we know that anyway, but boy, he proves it here.
I know, he's on his A game, as they say. He's tremendous. I mean, don't forget, I mean, you know, the previous year, the year before the lockdown, Garrett was touring the world with Druid in Godot and Richard III and so on. I mean, no, he's absolutely top of the range. And it's just an amazing privilege to be working with the likes of himself and Dennis and Alwyn. It's just and Dennis Clancy's soundtrack. I mean, I pinch myself because really the whole thing sort of fell together during the summer when people, unfortunately, had nothing better to do.
But you just go back a little bit, if you would, Eamon. You mentioned Garrett playing the ghost of Cuchulainn in Dusk. This the play of yours, as you said, staged in the GPO and the New Theatre in 2016, and all part of the centenary celebrations. Like Dennis Conway was in that play, if I remember right, as well.
That's right.
Was it something specific in the performance of Garrett there, do you think, that actually, I presume, I'm not sure what words came to you, but "What Dark Hour Is This" certainly is the first words we hear, and they jump out at you. "Testing times are these," he says a little bit further on. But was there something in Garrett's original incarnation of Cuchulainn that spurred you into this piece as well?
I've lived with that because Garrett's performance on stage every night was stunning at the time. And as you say, that voice. And so it sort of resonated. And I think it lodged in my subconscious. But out of the blue, I mean, there was no reason for it to sort of pop up, except maybe that we were all feeling vulnerable and stressed out and panicked. And suddenly this voice pops into my head. I thought, oh, my God, I'm having a breakdown. But so I ran with it. And I wasn't quite sure where this was going to go. I mean, the thing I've always been intrigued anyway by this Cuchulainn character. He's a flawed anti-hero. Yeah. And you know, he kills his best friend, he kills his own son, he has lots of mistresses, he gives his wife a hard time. So he's a strange guy, and he's always up for a fight. And I wasn't quite sure what it would be like. I mean, I love the Japanese no theatre, the no tradition, the no of the spirits, but I often wondered what it would be like if Cuchulainn was the spirit. And would he have learned anything on the wheel of reincarnation, so to speak? And I had no idea where this would go, but he's as boisterous and as belligerent as ever.
But is this the same Cuchulainn, I mean, that has, let's face it, he has been part of your artistic life for quite a long time, even when we go back to Horselips days and we go to the town and the killing of that friend, etc., etc., the story that's all within that. What is it about that specific character, do you think, from Irish mythology that speaks so clearly to you?
I'm still scratching that itch, trying to figure that one out. And I think that, well, of course, he is the archetypal hero, and and he's flawed. And I think we all possibly like to think that we have something good to offer, and at the same time, we know that we're not perfect. But in his case, you know, having grown up with the stories, you know, as a kid, I think before I ever saw a Marvel comic, I knew that, you know, this young fellow with a Hurley could sort of turn on a sixpence in a warp spasm and defeat an entire army. And I've always just been intrigued very much by the character. And he's never one to shirk a challenge. And there's just something, I like to think, maybe in the Irish psyche, that's a bit like that, that you'll never beat the Irish, you know, that old thing. And so, you know, I know that when we were working on the Toyn album, and that was a pop aesthetic, if you like, at the time. So I had to do something with him, and I called him Jarog Doom, the Red Doom, because it was a character in the Marvel comics called Doctor Doom. And I thought, Jarog, well, you know, Ulster's red hand and all that.
Yeah.
And so that was pop music. I was still scratching at this thing, sort of seeing, you know, there's something deep in the national psyche, and that's really what I was trying to scratch at to see if I could see what might emerge. And I was as surprised as anybody, because the weird thing is the lines just sort of flowed out. I mean, I couldn't get over it. And
were you? Do you think you were writing with the specifics of the three voices that you had at your disposal in mind, or were you even at the stage of having decided upon the three voices when you were writing initially?
No, I knew immediately. I mean, once the Cucullin character, I don't hear him now any other way other than Garrett Lombard's voice, and so it had to be Garrett. And thankfully, he was available, and thankfully, he said he'd yeah. try it. And then Dennis, of course, had to be involved because Dennis was involved in Dusk, and I learned so much working with Dennis. And so his character is essentially Tiresias, you know, that blind visionary seer, because I think the Irish mythology and Greek mythology, there's just so much. I mean, even before Horsips, when I was working with Tara Telephone, we were actually exploring, if you like, the sort of that nexus between the ancient and contemporary yeah. stuff. And so, you know, I didn't know where this was going to go, but ultimately, I think maybe in the remorse of Cucullin, that I began to maybe sense that maybe there was some sort of, if you like, redemptive power in grief and all that sadness that was washing around us.
And the other interesting thing is, I don't think I'm giving anything away by saying this, but ultimately what Cucullin says to us is, you know, because we all think, oh, right, so the hero comes back to save the day in Cucullin, if you like, you resurrect him to come and rescue us. The deus ex machina to keep yeah. feed to it. But in fact, what he's saying to us is the hero's within yourself. That's what you're going to have to find to get yourself through the dark times and the tough times.
And essentially, that's it. Yeah. And, you know, he's slightly lending a helping hand and giving it, just essentially just giving a bit of encouragement. And I think when we say him as well, I think it is just we're talking about something in the national psyche. He's this archetype. Now, he can sound quite ominous. And to be honest, I wasn't quite sure whether, you know, whether I was actually invoking this, you know, this threatening sort of character, or indeed whether this archetype, this sinister archetype, was actually sort of, you know, occupying me, so to speak. But I tell you, and the other great thing is, you know, when I knew we needed a sort of a chorus as a linking thing, and to share some insights as well. And when Andy said he'd speak to Alwyn, because Andy and I had worked with Alwyn and Kenny Hughes, Alwyn Furere. And so the great thing was when she read the piece, she said, look, you don't need to actually see me, she said, because technically this is the voice, this is the spirit of the land. I said, yeah, absolutely. So it's when you're working with people like that,
yeah,
who know what you're doing and are actually there ahead of you.
Yes.
Well, it's just a joy.
Well, let's finish up by listening to the one of the clips that features Alwyn. And in Dennis's case, we get a visual as well in his own home, I presume. And his, I suppose, the seer in some ways links the various passages for us. Alwyn has a type of choric role, as you say, a chorus in this. And just give me briefly, before we go into this section from her, the visuals that we get there are very different from either Dennis's or Garrett's. Tell us what we have.
Yeah, I felt, yes. And I think, you know, as Alwyn was saying, look, she said, you know, for my piece, I think maybe you should maybe use images of the sea and so on. So I said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll ring my cousin. So I rang Killian Ginnity, who's a videographer, and said, listen, could you go out and film some nature footage for us, please? And he lives down in County Meath. So he went into a local wood, and it was springtime, it was early spring. And there's just a few bluebells around, and the leaves aren't even on the trees yet. And he shot some stuff. And of course, once we all saw it, we went, wow, this is brilliant. It's all
perfect.
Just coming together.
Yeah.
And so whenever we hear Alwyn, we see sort of scenes from that wood or that stream.
Exactly, and that. And since we can't get out into the, in many cases, we can't get out into the woods or near the streams,
yeah,
if they're not within, if you're not 5K, if you're more than 5K from that type of natural surroundings, then we have to imagine it. Lovely to speak with you this evening, Eamon.
And you, Sean, yeah, brilliant.
And we'll get people to imagine that verdant landscape now as we listen to the voice of Alwyn Furere in the closing sections of Cucullin Awakes from Eamon Carr.
When this nettle rain has passed and storm winds all abate, time will pluck the sweetest bough and gild the hours with grace, as hearts, with sorrow lightened, embrace the afterglow. For dream time heralds wisdom, as all will come to know. The willow hangs in sadness, yet the wicker creel is strong. Draw down the moon and pointed star. Bid silver skies slide on. Lake waters whisper secrets. Great stones stand golden in the sun. And all around, a cloak of green. Green fields will never be undone. And all around, a cloak of green. Green fields will never be undone.
The voice of Alwyn Fuere there in Cuchulainn Awakes, which will be screened, the Imcar movie, which will be screened on Monday the 15th March on the dedicated TV station for the St. Patrick's Festival this year. It'll be available online for a week afterwards, and you can find out full details of where and how to access all of that on stpatricksfestival.ie. Lucian Freud was one of the great British painters of the 20th century, in fact, one of the century's great portrait painters. His portraits were overwhelmingly personal, many sitters drawn from his circle of family and friends. Amongst them, a series he painted during the 1970s of his mother, Lucy. That set of paintings has provided inspiration to another great portrait painter, Chantal Joffe, who has completed a set of paintings of her own mother, Daryl. And those paintings form part of a new exhibition at the Irish Museum of Modern Art entitled The Artist's Mother, Lucy and Daryl. With me this evening, Chantal Joffe and Annie Freud, the poet and eldest daughter of Lucian Freud, who has also contributed to this exhibition in the form of a recorded poem reflecting on her grandmother Lucy's flight from Germany in 1933 and an essay exploring Lucy Freud's influence on her son's art. I'm delighted to have both of them speaking with me this evening. Annie, I'll come to you first. And that relationship between your grandmother and your father, which I think is really important in informing the way he painted these portraits, particularly in the latter part of her life. In your essay, you give us great detail of the relationship between the two of them. It seems not an even-handed relationship.
There was between them a great deal of mutual love. It has to be said that my grandmother treated Lucian as the favourite. And that caused a kind of dynamic. My father found it very difficult that my grandmother, Lucy, regarded everything about him, not just as good, but outstanding and perfect in every way. And he found that sometimes quite suffocating.
And how do you think that feeling of suffocation that he had, how do you think that fed into particularly the paintings and the portraits that he made of her late in her life, which are the ones that Chantal has reacted to a large extent in this exhibition?
After my grandfather Ernst's death in 1917, my grandmother attempted suicide. She was found by her sister, Gerda. My grandmother recuperated to a certain degree, but she had been, all during her life, an extremely passionate person, extremely providing and generous, always talking, always singing, always telling stories. But she lost the passionate side of her nature to a very great degree.
So when we see in those portraits, for example, your grandmother really at rest and almost in repute, the painter's mother resting from 1976 is specifically the portrait I'm thinking of, where she is prone, lying on her back and very rested. There's a sense that perhaps there's more peace between them perhaps than there was in the earlier part of the life. Would that be fair to say?
She needed him less. My father, in his own words, says she lost interest in me.
Right. Chantal, it's a very interesting dynamic that Annie describes to us there, this kind of suffocating praise as a young child and as a young man, and then this change in the relationship coming towards the end of Lucian Freud's mother's life. When it came to you and painting a portrait of your own mother, what did you have to address in the dynamic between your mother and yourself when it came to making portraits of her?
I think I came to the thinking about it via Lucian Freud's paintings of his mum and thought about, initially tried to think about copying the compositions he'd used and things, but my mum isn't in any way a person you could direct in that way, so I couldn't paint her prone. She's, you know, sat quite upright or sort of slouched on the sofa or something. So I had to then immediately kind of go back to a whole other idea of approaching it.
I think you also, in terms of the colour palette that you were going to have to choose, she was very fond of navy as the colour for her clothes in the latter years, in this latter part of her life. Did that become a problem, saying to her, perhaps, Mum, would you try a different colour for me here?
Yeah, I mean, I think I love the pattern on Lucy's dress and the Freud paintings, the very elaborate paisley pattern and stuff. But my mum was in a navy V-neck jumper, so that wasn't going to be the same at all.
Annie, then, in terms of your grandmother, she was quite a woman and had quite a history, really, in terms of her flight from Germany, really, in the 1930s. Tell us about that early part of her life.
Well, she was brought up in a very in a wealthy household. She had a governess from Switzerland that had a great deal of influence on her. This governess was highly educated and helped my grandmother be ambitious, but also was extremely loving and protective. My grandmother spoke much more of her governess than of her own mother. She was unusual in that she studied both art history and the classics, and was a fluent speaker in Latin and the ancient Greek language. When I was really very, very young, she bought me Metamorphoses by Ovid and the Odyssey by Homer, and Herodotus's histories, and she'd read these aloud to me.
And what about that move from Germany in 1933? Did she talk much about the situation the family was in and their reasons for having to move to London or to England at that time?
No, that was rarely talked about. She had a very pronounced, very beautiful, but very pronounced German accent. And I can imagine what it must have been like to go to the greengrocers and buy onions and carrots and potatoes in a German accent, and how she handled herself and how she dealt with the kind of responses that must have been hostile sometimes.
Absolutely. The story, Chantal, of exile is also part of your own mother's story. She came to England in 23, when she was 23, rather. These are different circumstances. Just tell us a little bit about those. And do you think there are parallels there?
Yeah, I think there are parallels in the sense that my mum arrived in London at 23 and became a childcare officer. And I think for her it was a completely new place and a strange place, really. And then she moved to America at 26, where I was born. And then she came back to London in the 80s with us as children. But I think that thing of never quite belonging and never fitting in, I think they probably shared that in some ways. Maybe they have a kind of, always have, even to the children, a kind of, maybe a kind of foreignness because their childhood took place elsewhere and they're growing up. And maybe for the child, the adult child painting them, maybe they always regard them as slightly exotic in some way or foreign or sort of strange to them, and there's a kind of elusiveness to them perhaps.
And where had your mother come from? It was a different situation than the Freuds, who were coming from Germany in wartime.
Yeah, my mum was born in Zambia and grew up there and then came to London because she was not very happy with, you know, the situation there in the 60s. And hated, you know, apartheid and stuff. She came here to escape all that and to, because she objected to the situation.
Now, part of the exhibition that we're talking about at Emma is a poem of yours, Annie Freud, where you've spoken directly of the early experience, that 1933 experience of your grandmother. We listen then to the opening section of the poem, and this is fully available on the Emma website. The entire poem is there, but let's listen to the opening few minutes.
Hiddensay, 1933. She would have turned to face the little house, and in that moment on that summer's day would have seen the composition as a whole, thin curtains flapping at the windows, the shingle roof casting its crenellated shadow on the whitewashed wall, with deep-set rustic doors, the leaves of the sweet chestnut almost black against the sky, the tin bath, laundry bucket and washboard, broom draped with a cloth like a turban socialite, slippers propped on the step, the bicycle lying where it fell, familiar characters in a children's story conversing on the cobbles and rough grass. The news was bad and getting worse. People she had known were being murdered where they stood, and no one was saying anything. She would have run inside to grab her camera and clicked. All summer, the boys had fished and fought. Soon she would be packing up and leaving home for good. And there she was, removed to St. John's Wood, buying carrots in a German accent, too afraid to ask for directions on the underground, and surfacing at Harrow instead of Baker Street, from where she'd hoped to make her way to Swan and Edgar, with its thin-chested serving girls and air of dank refinement, to buy the vests and pants her boys would need for school.
The opening section there of the poem Hiddensay, 1933, read by Annie Freud. And Annie Freud is with us this evening ahead of the exhibition The Artist's Mother, Lucy and Daryl. The Daryl there being the mother of the artist Chantal Joffe, who's also speaking to us on this Friday evening here in Arena. Just to come to one other aspect of your grandmother's relationship with her father-in-law, Annie. Her father-in-law,
yes,
being Sigmund Freud, the father of psychoanalysis. He really approved of her methods of child rearing and the way that she was bringing Lucien up?
Well, I don't know exactly. He was tremendously touched by her grace, her devotion to motherhood, her sweetness. And also there was a great deal of expression of mutual affection between them. And this gave my grandmother a rather extraordinary confidence in herself. In the essay I wrote, there's a bit where I say that the id and the ego and totem and taboo were sort of part of daily life. And she often used to quote sayings by Sigmund. And there was particularly one that was, nec flera, nec ridera sed intellegera, which means do not deride, do not despise, but try to understand. And this was something that Freud himself would often say at his family gathering. And what it means is that there's a very human tendency to blame and to shame others. And if there could be some desire to understand without judgment, that we would perhaps live in a happier world.
It's also very interesting that when we think of Chantal Joffe in terms of the family and in terms of painting a portrait of a family member, and in your case we're talking about your mother, the objectivity that seems to be suggested in that ability not to blame, not to judge. How difficult is it to find that when it is a portrait that you're painting, as you were doing in this particular case, portraits of your mother? Objectivity must be an incredibly difficult thing to find. Is it necessary?
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult to find objectivity with your painting your mum. I mean, I would resist making the paintings for a long time because when I was painting them, I was thinking so intensely about our whole history as, you know, mother and daughter and my childhood and my relationship to her, and especially latterly her loneliness during lockdown and things like that. So it was very intense to paint her. There's one painting of her after she has a cataract operation, and I felt a lot of kind of a strange kind of guilt about painting that, making that painting.
Well, very interesting material indeed, and all of it on view at this exhibition. Thank you so much to both of you, Annie Freud and Chantal Joffe, for speaking to me this evening. And the exhibition is called The Artist's Mother, currently online at the Irish Museum of Modern Art. The exhibition also includes a series of 22 specially produced short videos with artists, writers and creatives in various reflections on the theme of mother, and that's called The Maternal Gaze. The Artist's Mother is the latest project in response to the IMA Collection Freud Project 2016 to 2021. This is the final year of the five-year project, and you can find out full details on IMA, IMMA.ie. And so to our album reviews on this Friday evening. First up will be singer-songwriter Megan O'Neill. You might have seen her on The Late Late Show recently performing her version of Time in a Bottle, commissioned for the Netflix series Firefly Lane. Her second album is out today. It's called Getting Comfortable with Uncertainty. We'll then speak about the Australian band The Paper Kites. Current album is a series of collaborations with different female vocalists, including Rosie Carney, Aoife O'Donovan, Julia Stone and others. The album is called Roses. And finally, described as feminist music trailblazer, Stepney Sisters turned down an opportunity to become part of Bob Marley's Wailers back in the 1970s, ploughing their own furrow instead. It didn't quite work out for them at the time, but almost 50 years later, they are back with their self-titled album. We will hear more of that story, no doubt, from reviewers Zara Hedeman and Brian Boyd in a short time. But first of all, let's start at home with Megan O'Neill. New album, Getting Comfortable with Uncertainty. And here's a track called Break Hearts.
I've got a picture as the background of my phone. I shouldn't consider what I want when we're alone. I don't wanna break hearts. Don't wanna be the one who messes up for the sake of just maybe this could be real love or feeling right. But I don't know how I can break hearts. Don't wanna be responsible.
Oh, sure, none of us want to be responsible for breaking hearts. That's Break Hearts from Megan O'Neill. You also heard the voice of Joseph Dunwell in the midst of that as well. And that is from Megan's second album, Getting Comfortable with Uncertainty. Zara Hedeman and Brian Boyd, as I said, are reviewers on this Friday evening. Recorded quickly this second album, Zara, after her debut, Ghost of You, which that really opened doors for her. How well established is she coming into this second album?
Well, coming into this second album, as you said there, this followed just 4 months after her debut. And after that, she amassed a really impressive success. She became number one on the iTunes singer-songwriter charts. She would open for Tom Jones. She was even invited to perform at a private Oscars party. So she's got some status there. But as you hear there on that Break Hearts, I mean, I think Megan O'Neill very quickly establishes how her aptitude for a pop hook. That song just sounds so natural and just at home, really being blasted on the radio. And actually, like in comparison to the rest of the album, it's quite a standout because it starts with some very strong, like Nashville contemporary country roots. So she really knows how to channel a hook and to really broaden her audience reach as well.
I've never heard somebody say aptitude for a pop hook with in such a loaded way, Zara. It sounds like a compliment, but I don't think it is. What about you, Brian Boyd? Did you hear that aptitude for a pop hook, and was it a good thing?
It's always a good thing. Pop's always good, Sean. I think a lot of country artists, they have a chip on their shoulder. They need to show us how flexible they are, how progressive they are, and they start melding with pop styles and electronica styles. I think Megan has, you heard her voice there, it's a fantastic voice. It's best suited to country roots type music. And on this album, you get very much two albums. There's up-tempo songs with electric guitars where her voice really is just chasing the melody. It doesn't suit her. On the song we just heard and the other slower tempo songs, which are more rootsy in nature, her voice brings you into this, sometimes almost into a Emmylou Harris wonderland. It's a fantastic instrument. I just wish she would I wish country artists would stop being ashamed of being country artists and just be, you know, dive right into it and give us the roots, give us Americana, and don't feel that you have to do a Taylor Swift and become all contemporary and pop and get your country album music onto the pop charts, because no one's interested in that.
What she's singing about in these songs, Zara, I'm suppose I'm specifically looking at track 4 on the album, which has the simple title, Ireland.
Yeah, Ireland is a bit of a standout actually in terms of the lyrical content. She prefaced this album by saying that it was a lot more personal than her previous, and I suppose here she wanted to kind of confirm her personal and professional autonomy. So there's a lot of like establishing her independence, but as you said, Ireland, it's very much a love song to her motherland. She throws out lines like, I'll take the rain instead of sun, and I've only learned to love you now I'm gone. So she does, while we have the pop and the country, she does also mingle in Celtic influences, which for me is the part of the album that just really didn't work at all.
I listened to the final track just before we get your final judgment on. The final track is called Winter Sun, and I think this was one of your favourites, Brian. I'll ask you about it afterwards.
Looking for the truth, fell so many times, but coming back to you, that is what brings me back to life. When I'm cold or when I'm frozen, take my hand, 'cause when you're holding, you melt away the winter. You know that when I'm with you, I can grow.
Winter Sun, the title of that final track on the album, Getting Comfortable with Uncertainty, from Megan O'Neill. I said that was one of the highlights on the album for you, Brian Boyd. Why briefly and stars at the end of that? Why?
It's because she's allowing, she's decreasing the instrumentation. She's allowing her vocal, which is a remarkable weapon she has, to be centre and front of the song. And on the other songs, she sounds identical. They just sound like it could be any singer in the charts. He says, I love the songs when she went more acoustic and when we learned a bit more about her. Stars, 3.5 stars.
3.5 from you, Brian. What are you saying overall on stars, Zara?
Overall, as I said earlier, Sean, and it wasn't emissive, you can't deny her, her songwriting chops. I think she has a great accessibility and universal themes. So for me, maybe a 3.
Yeah, sorry. Maybe I was putting a colour on my own colour on your comment, Zara, perhaps. Right. 3 from Zara on Megan O'Neill's second album. Let's move on then to The Paper Kites and Roses, 5th album from this indie rock folk band from Melbourne, Australia. Brian, their ethereal sound, is that a good description of what they give us generally, even before this album?
Very much so, yeah. They've been going for 10 years and they're in that sort of indie folk area where it's all very sort of gossamer thin acoustic guitar riffs, and you get those warm harmonies and you get the blissed out vocals, somewhat in the same ballpark as Fleet Foxes or Bon Iver. They're the sort of band, they can either, the mood they set can either elevate you emotionally or it can really irritate you.
Okay, this one is called Crossfire, and I presume they'll be caught in the crossfire between those two possibilities. Amanda Bergman is the vocalist here.
I was caught in a crossfire. I was still as the night. You were an angel in the shadows. When I saw the light, found your eyes in the darkness, found your face.
There you go. Am I feeling relaxed after listening to Crossfire? Am I feeling elevated or irritated? Or I suppose more importantly, are you feeling elevated or irritated after that, Zara Hedeman?
Well, I have to say, I completely agree with Brian there. It is an album where you can get elevated and irritated. And with that song, I really enjoyed Amanda Bergman's contribution to it. That song, from the moment it kicks in, just immediately reminds me of, say, Angelo Badalamenti or like Julie Cruz's contribution to Twin Peaks. I loved also how Bergman's vocals just reminded me of Cat Power, But then the irritation comes in when Sam Bentley, who is the frontman of the Paper Kites, comes in. I found that his presence repeatedly would disrupt my ability to fully settle into the songs, which is a shame because they have some great vocalists on this album. And I just found every time he appeared, I grimaced a bit and my enjoyment was compromised quite a lot.
Yeah, I wondered about, you know, these are great vocalists, Brian. Would they have been better in this case, the Paper Kites, to have just stuck with, let's give them, these vocalists, the songs and let them get on with it?
No, because this is a classic sadcore album. And by sadcore, what I mean is you get these sort of finger-picked acoustic chords, and every song here is the same. It starts off with that gentle finger pick chords, then you get the sad breathy vocals expressing a sort of a plaintive regret, and then almost the songs collapse under the weight of their own never ending melancholy and sadness. It's almost like listening into a grief counselling session. And the music on one of the songs, I could have sworn the music actually stopped out of solidarity with sadness for the singers. The singers all sound like they're going to stop and burst into tears at any second.
Well, let's have a listen to By My Side by Rosie Carney. I hope she has her Kleenex at the ready.
I'll light a flame and let it burn for you. And if I ran, then I would run. Every time, by my side, your place, by my side, it's where I wanna be, by my side.
By my side, the title of that from Rosie Carney that we hear singing the chorus there. Could you wait for her there, or were you already gone well before she arrived, Zara Hederman?
I could wait for her because I have to disagree with Brian. I don't think the women sound like they're going to break down in tears. I think it's more Sam Bentley. The women
keep the show on the road.
But what I do think, actually, you were kind of mentioning about the collaboration and does it work with them. I think that this album could have been a better maybe compilation as opposed to a concept album, and just focused maybe on the female vocalists as opposed to incorporating Bentley. Yeah.
All right. So how does that translate into stars for you, Zara?
The instrumentation is lackluster, but I loved a lot of the vocalists. So for me, it's going to be a 2 out of 5.
2 out of 5. What are you saying, Brian?
It's just way too delicate, way too super sensitive. You're in the ninth circle of acoustic singer-songwriter hell. So 1 star from me, Sean.
1 star from you, Brian. Okay, let's move on to Stepney Sisters. This is a great story. Pioneering 70s feminist rock band, finally releasing their self-titled debut album almost 50 years after they got together. And let's have a listen to a track before we talk about it. This is a track called Lonely Man.
Lonely Man. You'd like to think that you couldn't care less, then no one will see you're alone. Lonely man, why can't you cry? You bank on your freedom, but what can it buy? Hold in your tears, smother your fears. Lonely you'll live and lonely you'll die.
And that's a little snippet of Lonely Man from Stepney Sisters. Zara, this is a great story. We'll talk about the album in a minute, but tell me the story, first of all, who they were back in the 1970s and what they were doing then, which was extraordinary in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, their legacy in terms of being a household name may be modest, but in the 70s, in 1975, when they formed, they predated, you know, major feminist bands, say like the Raincoats. So they would have been the UK's first feminist ideological rock band. They would have played at a lot of women's liberation movement events. They would have set up workshops for women as well to get into music. But predominantly, like, they lasted for 18 months, and a lot of the reason for their demise was just kind of mainly financial, because they couldn't actually afford, they said in a recent interview, to actually get into the studio because it was such a phenomenal sum of money. There was also other kind of elements, domestic, internal strifes. But then they reunited for one of the members' 60th birthday 10 years ago, and then they finally got into the studio and then they recorded these songs, which were penned back in 1975 as well.
I don't think they would have gone into a studio probably back in 1975 because, Brian, they might have concerned, they might have been concerned about the money that was there. They had a great expression for... Go ahead.
Sorry. They would have been more concerned with the fact that the music studio would have been a manifestation of patriarchal capitalist bourgeois indulgence.
Yeah, they were very anti-capitalist. And the message within their songs in the 1970s was hugely important. Nobody else... Or was there anybody else with the political content that their songs had?
No, because they were a second wave of feminism, and their first front cover of a magazine was in Spare Rib, which it was a pioneering feminist magazine. It wasn't in a music magazine, and the songs are even though musically, I mean, we heard just there, and we will hear later that they are it's pure Philadelphia soul, but lyrically, like for example, when they write love songs, it's not a traditional love song. They're looking at the gender stereotypes inherent in the love song. And this comes through all the time. But musically, there's an awful lot going on. It's not just they've got that great Philly soul sound. They've got rock steady in there. They've got jazz. They've got lounge music. And remember also that this album, and this is where the story gets perhaps even stranger. This album was recorded by them in 2010, but the songs are all written in 1973 and weren't altered at all. So it's very much a time capsule. So it was delayed initially by 40 years, then delayed again for 10 years. And the only real letdown, sad thing here is the production is rubbish. It really is muddy and horrible.
Yeah, it's a great story, but unfortunately you're saying that the production lets it down. Stars from you, Brian?
3.5.
3.5. And what about you, Zara? Does the message and the story behind it overcome the problems with the record itself? There only are 8 songs in total.
Yeah, I think the message, I mean, it's very sad to see 50 years later how a lot of the themes and messages that they convey are still extremely relevant and resonating in between like the dichotomy and sexism and all that. So in that regard, it's a very important album. Production-wise, I wish it was a bit grittier, but I think it's really warm. I love the variations in it. So for me, it is a 3.
Right, okay, that's it. Zara Hederman and Brian Boyd on our albums this evening. Stepney Sisters, self-titled debut album after 50 years. Roses from the Paper Kites and Getting Comfortable with Uncertainty from Megan O'Neill. But that is our lot for this Friday evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Dave Gibson was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Bemi Rashliv, Aaron Lewin, Shock the Clock on Show, RTE Radio.